Hello, I'm John Waters, and I'm supposed to announce there is no smoking in this theater, which I think is one of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard of in my life. How can anyone sit through a length of a film, and especially a European film, and not have a cigarette? But don't you wish you had one right now? And I'm telling you, smoke anyway. It gives ushers jobs. And if people didn't smoke, there would be no employment for the youth of today. So once again, no smoking in this theater.
My noise situation is pretty good, but they're doing construction next door very weirdly, sporadically, so it could just suddenly happen that there's a lot of noise, and I'm hoping that doesn't happen.
That's part of the ambiance. Is this how they speak in that town of you guys?
They love the word ambiance in New York.
Yeah, we do, actually. So that's a thing. It's been going on for like a year and a half. Actually, I'm very fed up.
God damn.
Classic. Yeah,
for real.
That's great.
You got to get out of Brooklyn. You got to get to Minneapolis, which is where the Trilon is. Thank you very much for listening, everybody. It was my smoothest transition I could possibly muster. Wow. Welcome and thank you for listening. Yeah, I know. Thank you for listening to Trilove. It's a literal roundtable podcast, as we call it, where we talk about people we've met or movies we've seen at the Trilon Cinema in Minneapolis, Minnesota. You can find the Trilon at Trilon Cinema and at trilon.org. That's where you can get tickets and merch and other cool ways to support the Trilon. My name is Jason Daphnis, and you can find me on Twitter at Nintendoofus.
You don't have a quote this time, Jason?
I didn't know which one to pull. No, sometimes
there
I do,
are a lot
and
of
I didn't
really
prep our guests, so yeah.
Yeah, that's fair. Well, that is not a normal peasant riot, and I'm Harry Mack, and you can find me on Twitter at PunishTake.
So completely thrilled to be joined by two guests. Chris Montello, I want to make sure that I get the title right, programming manager for the Asian American International Film Festival and programmer for Slam Dance Film Festival in New York. Chris, introduce yourself.
Yes, thanks. And also just a correction, Slam Dance is it's in Park City, Utah.
Uh-huh.
With Sundance.
Your influence reaches
awesome. Yeah, far wow, beyond all New over York. The place.
Yeah. It's because we love them so much at AAFE. You know, we got a lot of films from there, and I was like, hey, can I program this one too? You know, AAFE, or the Asian American International Film Festival, is a film festival here in New York City that dates back to 1970s Chinatown. It's actually the oldest Asian American festival, as opposed to being kind of Asian. It's very local. It's sort of, you know, for the Asian community in New York City, by the Asian community, often about the Asian community. We had Ang Lee back in the day was an alum. You know, it has like a long storied New York Asian history. So I'm very proud to be a part of that.
It's so cool.
Yeah, I've been doing that for however long ago 2018 was, 6 years ago. So that's a cool thing. Cool thing that I do.
It is indeed. And it's one of the reasons we're really excited to talk about today's movie with you. Before we do that, I have to remind everybody. So we have, if you listened to any of the four previous episodes that this guest has been on, you'll know maybe some references. I think you've referenced the director of this movie on the podcast before. Blake Hester returns to the podcast. You My last God. Heard him in January. Go off, King.
I broke form. Usually I come here on January. I start the year hot and then I disappear forever. Letting other guests try to live up. Try love to live up. However,
nice.
You had my man Fukusaku on.
Yeah.
I had to come through.
That's the thing. You're our January/Fukusaku correspondent.
Yeah, and unfortunately, here's the thing. The Big King, he made a stink.
The Big King made a stink. Find him on Twitter at MetallicaIsRad and at BlakeHester.rocks. Check those things out. Aaron, the man who usually has the patented Aaron Grossman summary, is unfortunately, at least physically, unavailable to record with us today. We're down to, but we've managed to, I mean, maybe
wait, what does that mean, physically unavailable? As opposed to what?
You'll hear. He makes a small appearance. I got it. But it's up to me to introduce today's film through, once again, thank you so much to our guests for joining. I'll give a quick overview of the movie just for those who may haven't seen it for a little while. We'll get into the main discussion with what I like to call the patented Aaron Grossman summary, which Aaron always kicks off, and I must honor his memory by doing.
Yes, indeed, folks.
If you don't know, that's the voice of Aaron Grossman. So we have Samurai Reincarnation, aka Makai Tinsho, is a 1981 fantasy action film written and directed by Kenji Fukuzaku. It's the guy that is on Blake's shirt right now. Is that actually the man himself, or is that just a still from one of his movies?
It's a man. It's the man himself.
The man himself.
Hardcore Chocolate does a whole Kenji Fukuzaku Toei line.
And hell yeah.
That rules, dude.
Yeah, yeah. I got a whole bunch of them, but this is one of the Fukuzaku specific shirts.
Well, you hopefully that this movie, based on your opinion of it, has not tarnished much his reputation, because we have a little bit more to go through here, but I think some of us had a more positive opinion. Shiro Amakusa is played by Kenji Sawada, is the sole survivor of a massacre of Japanese Christians during the Shimabara Rebellion. Witnessing the devastation, Shiro renounces his Christian God and vows vengeance on the Tokugawa regime that perpetrated the massacre. Now in league with Satan, Shiro gains the power to resurrect the dead and assembles a team of the aggrieved undead to execute his plans, including disgraced samurai wife Gracia Hokusawa, played by Aki Kokano, the lustful monk Inshin Hozuin, played by Hideo Murata, the legendary swordsman Miyamoto Musashi, in a completely bizarre, I had no idea Musashi was going to show up in this fucking movie, played by Ken Ogata. Just what a wild ass movie. And young ninja Kirimara Iga, played by Hiroyuki Sanada, everybody's favorite.
Boy, is he ever. I was just watching Shogun. And
oh,
like,
is he in that too?
Literally, yeah. It's 43 years apart, and it's like set in the same era and everything. And like, I literally flipped over from Shogun to watch this for the pod, and I was like, you can't get away from him. Sonata's everywhere.
He's, thank God he's everywhere. The actual movie follows Shiro's group as he amasses his demonic force, pursued by Musashi's rival, Jubei Yagyu. Excuse me. I want to make sure that I'm, yes, Jubei Yagyu, played by Sonny Chiba, the classic, I guess, frequent collaborator of Fukuzaku. This is, spoiler alert, my first Fukuzaku, even though I own one or two, thanks to Blake himself. The film won two of its three awards of the Japanese Academy back in the day for its art direction and for Hiroyuki Sanada as newcomer of the year in his acting role. So I want to toss to Chris first, because you're new to the pod, but this is an open-ended question. One, do you have background with Fukuzaku? And two, what is it about that guy?
I don't really have too much of a background with Fukuzaku. I had only ever seen Battle Royale, which I had seen many, many years ago. I rewatched Battle Royale. I was like compelled to rewatch Battle Royale last night. I was like, oh man, that was a great movie. I remember seeing it on its like first theatrical release in the US at the IFC Center like 10 Jeez. Or so years ago. And, I think I had seen it before then when it was more like obscure, because I actually was reading about it. The rights were sort of, there was no distributor in the US. So it was like this cool underground cult movie. And I think that, in a way, you know, I had never seen Samurai Reincarnation before, but, it really took me back to that era of being like a teenager seeking out these like cult Asian movies. Like it brought me back to like, to that, that time. So even though I'd never seen it before, there was something like cool and nostalgic about it. But that's really, you know, all I can say. It just makes me want to go watch a bunch of Fukuzaku. I'd only seen those two movies.
Which is an interesting inverse of what I assume Blake's opinion on this movie is. What is it about Fukuzaku, Blake, and what is it about this movie in particular?
Man, this movie, nothing really. I'd never seen it before. And I was like, oh, that's a good excuse to watch another one. He's one of those directors where it's like, some directors, you're like, I've seen 10 of their movies. They're one of my favorite directors. Everyone's like, great, you've seen their whole catalog with Fukuzaku. It's like, oh, great, you've seen a fourth of his catalog. So it was like just one I hadn't seen, so I thought I'd check it out. But specific to your other question, I found him by way of like loving various crime movies. Like I'm a big, you know, Scorsese head. I loved Miike. Miike influenced by Fukuzaku. So I just naturally made my way to him. And I think watching the stuff he did in the early 70s, specifically like the Battles Without Honor and Humanity series, but also the movies he made briefly before that, some of the other Yakuza stuff he made around that. He made a ton of fucking Yakuza films on top of like sci-fi movies. And he's one of those classic Japanese directors where he did every genre and a lot of it. Finding those movies and just seeing like his approach to it, like the way he films violence and action and the way his films just feel very renegade and punk rock, and the way it made other directors kind of make sense in my head, like Japanese directors, of course, like Kiyoshi Kurosawa and Takashi Miike, but also William Friedkin, a director I love who loves Fukusaku. Like, it was just natural. I'd gravitate towards him. And also, frankly, dumbing it down, he makes cool dudes look cool. And like, I love, you know how you're not supposed to watch mob movies and like the mobsters? I don't care. I'm watching a Fukusaku joint and I'm like, yeah, I know also, they suck. They're cool.
Nobody really believes that, right? I mean, come on.
For sure. Get off your fucking high horse.
And Battle Royale is actually one of the movies I always forget he directed. And I love that movie. I'm not trying to act like holier than thou. Like, I think that's one of my favorite movies of all time. But somehow I forget he directs it. And then when I remember, I'm like, oh, yeah, of course. He's the GOAT of all time.
Because he's like, that's kind of the movie he's most well known for now.
Sure.
But it's like very late in his career after he made like 50 movies, many of which were very famous, including Battles Without Honor or Humanity, which is how I was introduced to him.
And it's his last movie.
I do love it. Like, it's one of those things where it's like, I mentioned Scorsese earlier. He's a dude who feel like when you watch a Scorsese movie from the early 70s to Killers of the Flower Moon, it's like he's never lost the plot. Like, he has always had five core things he wants to say, right, and he has said it for 50 years. And Fukusaku is the same way. Like, you watch his earliest Yakuza movies and you watch his very last movie and you're like, he was saying the same fucking thing the whole time. And so I love that. And you feel it here when you see like his take on like this era of Japan and Christianity.
Yeah, even
it's like
in
he's
this movie,
still on it. Yeah.
Right. It's like this movie is so fucking cynical and so like dour and critical of like Japan and also just sort of humanity in general, that it's like, it's so clear that this is the dude who made Battles Without Honor and Humanity and the dude who made Battle Royale and everything. It's like, fuck, like this guy really knew what he wanted to use his artistic career to do and did it, you know?
It's a guy who hates America and Japan so much that he dedicated his life to making the best movies in the world about it.
Well, give me a little bit of color there, because there's like as context in, you know, and I am, as you know, Chris, you described different audiences for different types of like Asian film distribution. I'm definitely on the, I need the one that's like kind of positioned for white guys, because I don't know the context. I don't know the background, the history. I'm just sort of a, you know, a blithering Midwesterner over here. Just after watching this movie, like obviously the very quick hit of it is there were like attempts at colonial power under Catholic and Protestant, you know, missionaries in Japan during the period in which this movie is set and around it, you know, sort of patriotic and militant Japanese leaders sort of rejected it, outlawed it. There were many movements to try and like sustain it. You sort of see the parallels of appeal between one, like, you know, outside faith being brought in to colonize and to usurp secular power and open trade routes with Portugal, Spain, and other, you know, parts of Europe, and the sort of like isolationist closing off of Japan as its own, you know, in interior, we'll say, like its own insulated environment. And that's explored through this movie in a very, very heightened, dramatic, you know, almost goofy, well, pretty blatantly goofy, Shakespearean heightened dramatic way. But like, maybe give some color to that based on what you know, your experience in a programming Asian film. And I assume having seen a lot more than I have, for like what set the stage for this movie's, what this movie's doing in terms of what Blake is saying, like repeating that same message of sort of an anti-Western, anti-imperial, view of you know, the different forces at play in this movie.
Well, I see it about as being about violence chiefly, right? I think that in just a larger sense, what implicates both the Western powers and the Japanese powers is that they're militarized. There are these, you know, like the Tokugawa has, you know, this huge army. He commits this genocide against the Christians. You know, there, you know, it's he has everybody, you know, under his thumb, and that's why he must suffer. Like, all of these characters that are reincarnated, and by the way, I keep wanting to call this movie Samurai Resurrection, because that feels like a more natural
title. I kept accidentally calling it that. Absolutely.
Yeah. But Samurai Reincarnation. I might slip and call it Resurrection. I want to call it Resurrection. But in any case, you know, these characters that are being reincarnated as devils, you know, what motivates a lot of them is just this thirst for for battle or for vengeance. I think that like one of the craziest scenes in the movie is Sonny Chiba's dad, where he's like, I don't have unfinished business. I don't need to become a devil, but don't you want to challenge your son? Like, go.
It's so fucking cool.
You want to be like the final boss of the movie? And he's like, oh yeah, I guess I do want to do that. So like on every level, like on a micro level and a macro level, you know, all of these characters are sort of stuck in these cycles of vengeance and violence. And I think that what makes it interesting is that he's sort of putting that lens on history, that that's the problem with Japan. That's the problem with the West, is this sort of thirst for dominance and violence. I think that there's like a really interesting through line in this movie that didn't have to be there, you know, but he does have something to say, which I think is fascinating.
Jumping off Chris's point, which I think is excellent, there's a really interesting story that's told a lot. Like, I'm not breaking new ground here, but there's a story about Fukusaku that I think like kind of colors his whole career. And when he was a kid, he worked in a munitions factory during the war effort, during World War II. Everyone's chipping in. He obviously bought into, you know, helping out his country, all this stuff. It was bombed. The munitions factory was hit. Most of, if not all, his friends died. And he was like quite literally one of the people picking up his friends, you know, other children's limbs to clean up. And it was like that moment where he gained his like anti-authority like through line that he carried his whole career. And I think like once you know that that is a part of his early life,
right,
his entire filmic history, you're like, oh yeah, I get it. I absolutely get it.
Right. Yeah. I just want to say, yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No, you please.
No, I just want to say, like, I just realized I went through this whole thing about violence, violence, violence in Japan without even just saying the words, like, this is because of World War II, you know, like, so it's like such an important context for so many Japanese filmmakers of that time. I mean, I know I'm not I've seen a lot more Nobuhiko Obayashi than I have.
I was also going to name drop Obayashi.
He's the guy.
I'm putting my hand down because like, I was going to do the same thing.
Yeah. Like, he's the guy that I'm thinking of now. Like, I'm a little bit more familiar with his films, but just to think about Labyrinth of Cinema, and then there's that great one. What's it called? Is it Casting Blossoms to the Sky? That's an incredible movie.
Yeah.
Like just the way that he keeps bringing up, like, this horrible experience of being in World War II. I mean, that is kind of what this movie, that's what it comes down to. Right, it's this experience, and that's a great biographical detail to share. I didn't know that.
I've always thought of Fukusaku as like he's like the feral Obayashi. Obayashi is like beautiful and sentimental, and Fukusaku is just like, what if we took all of the rage and like distilled it into a director? I'm always reminded of like, I think one of my favorite like first half hours of any movie ever is the first Battles Without Honor or Humanity, which takes place like in the immediate aftermath of World War II. And the way Fukusaku shoots it is it's just like fucking anarchy. Like it's just, there are just bodies on the shore. There are like people fighting in like the literal burning ruins of the city.
I don't say this flippantly, but I think if you could crystallize Fukusaku's whole thesis as a filmmaker, it's the opening of that
movie. That movie, right?
Where an American GI attempts to rape a Japanese woman.
Right.
Like that's like the, it's like, I don't throw that out flippantly, but I do think that is like him putting a state, like a line in the sand, be like, this is what I'm all about.
And like, it's an obsession of Fukusaku's that recurs throughout his filmography. And like, I really love it here as well. And it made me like this movie more than I maybe would have otherwise. But, it's this obsession with like Fallen Empire, or like the aftermath of like there was a project, right? There was like an idea that something was going to be built. Fukusaku is not necessarily interested in that. He's interested in what happens after it collapses and what that looks like. And here he is taking his anti-authoritarian sort of criticisms of American and Japanese imperialism and what they lead to inevitably, and he's like projecting it backwards through Japanese history, and he's doing it to like, he literally like recasts these actual historical figures. Every character in this movie is a real person who existed in history. And like gives them these wild backstories and these wild dark desires that they're struggling with. And it's just like the most cynical, most pessimistic possible interpretation of these characters that are very beloved often in Japanese history and fiction. And it's just like so quintessentially Fukusaku that this movie is like a big flaming fuck you to like Japanese historical mythology because of like, and his point is like, look, when something like this happens, when a massacre, right, which this, again, a real massacre, the Shimabara Rebellion actually happened. The Tokugawa shogunate massacred, like literally executed something like 37,000 people to the point where like all of the like villages around that region of Japan were depopulated because the Tokugawa shogunate just like cracked down and were just like, actually, like, fuck Christians, like, we're just going to put all of this away for now. And then we're going to close the borders for 200 years until the Bakumatsu, right? And so, like, and Fukusaku's point is like, hey, like, there's no escaping from the agony of something like that creates. And, like, we have to, like, reckon with that. There's like, a great sort of, like, angry justice to this movie that isn't interested in, like, morality and isn't interested in, like, making some sort of sweeping statement other than sort of like, hey, like when something like this happens, like we can't forget it. We can't walk away from it. And it is going to affect everything. Right. And so like, that's how you get to like Fukusaku's like apocalyptic sense of outrage where he's just like, hey, like there is nothing to be built out of something like this. When something like this happens, it's the end, right? It's like, yeah, like the evil 17-year-old beheaded Christian warlord leader is always going to come back and try to make trouble for humanity now because like that's what you did, motherfucker, right? It's like that's what you've earned. And like his Fukusaku's sort of interpretation of Japanese history is just that happening over and over again, right? It's mm-hmm. brutal.
Yeah, it's what you're like how you're positioning that, I think, is wise that in that it's like not just he's saying, you know, the sort of like external influence of, you know, Japanese missionary or excuse me, Christian missionaries, Catholic missionaries, Protestant missionaries during this period of time were like a corrupting force or whatever, that it was like it did justify this incredible like violence on from both sides. And it like brought out the politically violent tumultuous time for the whole nation. And like I guess it's that it to and I don't see this before Chris and Blake both bring it up, but like the universality of that violence, it's not just that, you know, there's this indulgent form of power that Shiro is selling to you know the people, to individuals and like the entire rioting populace, but that like it's that violence is, excuse me, going back to my notes to make sure that I know what I want to say, like that is directly opposed to these like naturally, like not naturally, but, you know, imposed virtues of honor and, you know, and like respect that dictate Japanese society at the time. And it's not saying that like that is the good way and that Shiro is a usurper of that order. It's saying these are both like inherently, repulsive, right? Like, it's because the people have qualms with their local shogunate. It's because they're highly taxed and underrepresented and ignored and, you know, made to be subservient to and pay incredibly high fees to like host a hunting warlord that they do revolt. And he inspires like a more violent form of protest. And like he instills this like deathly spirit in them to go siege the castle. But it's saying that both sides of this, if it's a conflict between like, if we're blowing it out on the metaphorical level to like the, you know, sort of like usurping Christian force and the traditional Buddhist and Shinto forces, then we're saying that both have their inherent like disgustingness, I guess, like, because one has instilled this form of power that necessarily pushes down at the lower class, at the disadvantaged, at those who are not of high birth. And the other one is saying you can enact incredible violence that's opportunistic, that is just for vengeance in the case of everybody who's inspired by Shiro or resurrected by Shiro. It's not saying that one is like the right way and one is the wrong way. It's saying these are both disgustingly violent the forms of power. It's just that this one is like makes for a good ghost story. And this one is social commentary, I guess, is how I was watching this movie, not having, again, seen any other Fukasaku films before.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there is no clear, it's not so clearly delineated as heroes and villains. You know, I think that, you know, like the first, I don't know, like almost hour of the movie is just sort of justifying why it is that these characters want to become vengeful mm-hmm. devils. I think that they're the most interesting characters. I mean, Sonny Chiba's character, he's ostensibly the hero. As far as I remember, like his whole involvement in the story is kind of just that he wants to train under Musashi. Isn't that how he's yep. introduced? Like he just wants to get stronger. He's just the dude like, I want to fight these people because fighting is what I do. Like right. even he's not champ. He's not like I need to save Japan. I need to save the Shogun. You know, he just wants to get stronger. Everybody just has their own violent driven motivation. And I don't know that we're necessarily meant to see any of these characters as chiefly good or chiefly evil. And you know, I think nowhere is that more tragic than in Sonata's character. You know, that ninja character, is probably one of the best characters in the movie. I mean, this guy, I don't know that he's an historical figure necessarily.
I believe he's the only fictional character, right? Because he doesn't have a last name, and he's yeah. a ninja, and ninjas weren't necessarily historical figures, right?
Exactly.
Kind of by design, and yeah.
Yeah, his village, in the movie, he's introduced because his village is destroyed by a different clan that has a tie to the Shogun. And his village is destroyed, so he's like this poor kid, like this teenager, who watches everybody that he knows dies, and then he dies too, I guess. Like, he's also killed in this conflict. So the devils, they latch onto him as somebody that they can essentially mold into a vengeful spirit, but he's just a kid. In a way, you know, this is kind of what, you know, the connection to these other films. I mean, in a way, like, here's like Battle Royale vibes, right? This kind of child soldier character who is compelled to join in this crusade, you know, simply because he is easy to manipulate, easy to ply and shape into this warrior for the sake of the devils. But he gets a lot of character development. He falls in love. There's like this kind of love story where he realizes, oh, actually, I'm not a devil. I'm you know, he changes sides and.
It's very bizarre. It's like very Seven Samurai, where it's like all of a sudden there's just like a love plot in the middle yeah. of this, and you're sort of like, what the hell? Yeah.
Well, they try to compel him to rape the. They're like, isn't that how it goes? Like, oh, you love this girl, that's fine because you can just rape her. That's what devils do, and that will like complete your transformation into a devil. Like, totally. It feels like this same sort of battle royale. The adults are trying to get these. This child essentially to do this horrible thing to be so that he can become irredeemably evil and can help them to join in their crusade. I mean, I don't know. I mean, they're definitely, yeah. I mean, it just, yeah. I mean, like, I think that context of Fukasaku's experience in World War II does, and being a child during that time, it's easy to see that, even in this movie.
One of the things I love that he does, which I mean is not specifically unique to him, but is he takes like very famous Japanese media archetypes like Yakuza, samurai, whatever, and robs them of their nobility, right? Like his Yakuza movies, they were coming out in the era, I don't remember exactly what it's called in Japanese, but they were coming out in the era of the honorable Yakuza,
right.
which
and
are
they were like hugely radical. They completely yeah, like reverse yeah. course on that.
Yeah. And you know, a lot of the honorable Yakuza movies were like funded by the Yakuza. Like they were effectively criminal propaganda. Yeah. So that, and I he still made the Yakuza cool, which is like, you know, you kind of missed your thesis slightly there, but I get what you're going for.
But you gotta hand it to him, yeah.
For sure. And I often think back, the Yakuza game series is so popular now, and I do think about that, where it's like, I love those games, but it's like, if Kiryu Kazuma isn't involved in it, he's at least friends with some people who are doing probably sex trafficking, you know? Like, let's just be honest with ourselves here.
Oh, I mean, the games are very much about that. Yeah, it's so funny and so weird.
But anyway, bringing it back to this movie, like the samurai, at least for a white dude who lives an ocean away, it is like one of those things you see in media is like they're so noble. You know what I'm saying? And it's like, I don't know anything about real samurai. Maybe they were, maybe they weren't. But you watch this movie and it's like, you're not getting that out of this. Everyone here kind of sucks. They have their own reasons for sucking. I'm boiling it down to its most basic, but
yes,
like,
yes.
You watch it and you are like, you all have used the word cynical a lot. Like, it is just like, you just feel like you are in the muck with these guys and you do not come out the other end being like, wow, the samurai were so cool. You come out of this being like, I don't want to watch that again. That was rough. And yeah. I love that, right? Like, I love flipping history on its head in that way and like taking an eye to the media you partake in. Like, he's a director in movies. He could easily probably just make these kind of propagandized films about samurai and yakuza, and he instead uses it to like poke holes in the like nationalist dream of Japan and be like, was everyone good? Were we always doing this good thing? You get what I'm saying. Like, I don't want to speak too much about a country I don't live in, but I love that angle he brings to his films, which other directors do, sure, but like as one of the more famous ones.
There's something interesting to note about what you're saying. I just want to mention that the movie is called Samurai Reincarnation in English, but in Japanese it's Makai Tensho, which means something more like, it's like, I guess Makai is like Devil World. It's also in the Japanese title of the Ghosts and Goblins game. So, Ghosts and Goblins is Makai Mura. So it's like Demon World Village. So anyway, this movie is like Demon World Reincarnation, not Samurai Reincarnation. So I wanted to bring that up as saying like, the marketing is samurais are cool, so we'll make the title something to do with samurais. You know, I'm sort of reading that into why it's called
Samurai Reincarnation. That's a really great point, because also like I had said, with like continuing Fukusaku's like fallen world obsession, right? It's like we never see the versions of these characters that are the versions from history. We only get to see the relitigated versions, right? We never get to see Amakasa Shiro, the devoted Christian. We only get to see him as like the leader of this devil rebellion. We get to see Musashi at like the end of his life making the sort of tragic flaw mistake that humanizes him and dooms him to become a devil, right? And this happens over and over again. It's like, it's so explicit, right? Like, literally, there are like title cards in the first half of this movie, Hell Chapter 1, Hell Chapter 2. And it's point by point Fukusaku walking back through history and finding a famous figure from Japanese history and relitigating their life story in the most contemptuous way possible, right? It's like actually like this person who refused to commit suicide because of Christianity, secretly she was obsessed with like her own beauty and her husband and lust, and that was her real like characterizing pulse. Like Musashi was actually like this wonderful warrior, this peerless warrior, actually like struggled with an inferiority complex for his entire life, and that defined who he was. And it's like this, you're taking the most, again, cynical interpretation of these characters, and also like this really human interpretation. What I really love about Fukusaku is that like, I love that, like, it's not just anti-authoritarianism for anti-authoritarianism's sake, which would be enough, but it's also just because, like, people are a fucking mess, right? And so, like all of these people are, like, their interpersonal lives are just messy. They are slaves to their lower ids, to what they want, to their egos, to their desires. And like, that is the fly in the ointment that he's sort of like, hey man, like none of this was ever going to work out. Like, watch this happen over and over again. Like, your famous figures from history, the greatest swordsman of all time, he was actually like this like petulant, like selfish person. And like, hey man, like this other, like this warrior monk who was known as holy in his own time, he secretly like dreamed of killing women because he couldn't contain his own lust, right? And it's just sort of like this, like he really wants to poke holes in this idea to get at this place where one thing I think is really interesting about this movie is, like, maybe the only people who are at all sympathetic are just the villagers who get slaughtered, right? Who are, like, manipulated by these larger forces into doing the bidding of the Christian warlord and then the Tokugawa shogunate. And they are just completely, like, at the mercy of these horrible events that are shaping them, right? And Fukusaku does this incredible thing where he's so good at shooting crowds of people. And, like, there's so much chaos in all of his movies, and including in this movie, that you just see people, like running around, and it's just so obvious that Fukusaku is just like, we have lost the plot, right? If there ever was a plot, like, it is gone. We are now living in this hellscape where, like, this is what it means to, like, to be under the thumb of these historical narratives, is actually, like, you're one of the people running in this crowd and getting mowed down for absolutely no reason, right?
Yeah, and I really like that you brought up specifically Musashi as a character, because, like, most people in this movie are, like, egged on into, like Chris brought up earlier, Yagyu, I forget the character's, like, given name, but the father of Jubei is egged on significantly to the point where he's dying, and the demons say, like, well, don't you want to, like, prove your mettle in battle against you? Don't you want that, like, last gasp at honor? And he says, yeah. And then he accepts. In the case of Musashi, he convinces himself all alone, exiled in a cave, that he wants, like, I thought I was missing something, because it's just shot after shot, close up of his sweating eyes behind his mask, just like convincing himself that he has this rivalry that's left unfinished, that he's just, like, going completely mad with this hubristic, like, rage. I love
Which,
that,
again,
that, like, it,
a
he doesn't
very historical figure and yes. kind of beloved in Japan.
Right? And they say, like, he was, like, shitting, pissing and crying because he couldn't beat his one rival one last time. And, like, and then the demons come in and they're like, all you got to do is say the word, as this little shitty Jiminy Cricket, to say, like, you can have what you want. But we didn't inspire you to want that. Like, he just wants that all alone on his own. And I just love that is the tack that's taken here in the writing and through the direction, is, like, just watching that character, like, quickly, I won't say slowly, quickly go quite mad on his own, rather than being, like, inspired or you know, like, driven to it by some ethereal force, as a lot of the other characters, individual and, like, you know, class-based, are. It's he is, like, he's the character, he's the cool guy, he's the, like, greatest swordsman in Japan, he showers with his swords, and yet he goes so mad with that bloodlust that even before the demons enter his life, he knows that he wants this, like, inherently evil, bad, hubristic thing before he's ever even dead. I just really like that's how we build that character that quickly.
And let's not forget, also, I think there's one character that we haven't even really touched on, which is Hozoin, the monk.
Who
he's compelled to join the devils because they convince him that his life was with, like, that they convince him, they basically ply him with sex, right? Where it's like, you are this honorable chaste monk, now you're in hell, all bets are off, like, you know, they didn't let you lust after women, so now we're gonna let you do that. So all honor is just out the window for these characters.
It's such a fantastic interpretation, right? Because, like, generally, like, in at least, like, well, it's complicated, right? But, like, in a lot of Judeo-Christian, like, mythology, like, the devil is the perpetrator of these like, we blame him, right? And it's like, if the person succumbs to temptation, it's a tragedy, right? Because their faith wasn't strong enough or whatever. But, like, the devil planted those thoughts, right? Whereas here, that is very clearly, like, subverted. Like, Amakasa Shiro is, like, absolutely, like, he knows these people. He's right about them, right? Which is such a great, like, subversion, because Fukusaku feels this way. You would have to think that, like, hey man, like this isn't a case of, like, the devil that tempted a great warrior into becoming a tragic shadow of himself, even though some of the characters in the movie itself interpret it that way. It's like, no, like, we are going to very carefully show you, like, before these guys died, Miyamoto Musashi was a crazy person who just, like, wanted to kill people. This monk, before he died, had dreams about killing women. Like, the reason why the devil was able to manipulate these temptations is because they already existed. They were already definitive of these people's real selves. And like, that's how we got to this place. And that's why it was such a mistake to view these people in any other way, right? Like, it's almost rather than this sort of like, reincarnation being this sad, like, mockery of what always was. This is like, we were meant to believe, like, this is what Shiro always was. This is what the rebellion always was. This is what these historical figures always were, right? And it's like, it's a really sad, tragic, but also like angry interpretation, right? Where it's like, Yagyu, like, when he is fighting his son, trying to kill his son, that's Yagyu, man. Like, that's his truest self, right? And the same is true of all of these other historical figures. It's like, Fukusaku is like showing you, like, this is what it was really always all about.
Yeah, it makes me think, the conversation thus far makes me think, you know, watching the movie as well, about, I don't know that this is considered Jidaigeki as a film genre, like, you know, the Honorable Samurai or the End of an Era type Wild West stories of Jidaigeki that were so popular from the like 50s through, I guess, the 70s. They still had juice, I guess. In the 80s, you had like Kagemusha and Ran and things that, like, you know, sort of iterated on that formula or from the masters. But as far as I know, not a whole lot of 80s movies end up on best of Jidaigeki lists. And I would assume that this one doesn't either, because it doesn't really feel that way. But it feels like a fun heightening of that form to me, that like there's this highly Shakespearean thing about, you know, the temptation of otherworldly power and, you know, everybody undone by their own hubris kind of thing, but also with this, with a few people sort of pulling the strings, but with very comic book thin premise type stuff that's just enriched with these very largely, I guess, before I watched this movie, I assumed there was something far more, I guess, directly plot driven. A lot of this movie happens outside of the direct control of Shiro or influence of Shiro. It's, you know, watching those characters sort of bounce off each other and, you know, move closer and further from each other and building them as people before they're turned sometimes. And I guess it's just like, it made me think of that form, and how like it rings a lot out of the bare structure of that story, without like feeling way too fluffy or empty, I guess. It's not the meatiest premise of, you know, he's going to assemble a team and attack the Tokugawa shogunate and lose, because you kind of know how history went. But he has, like, they managed to pull a lot out of the characters. Though. Well, technically, yeah. He loses his head. Like, you had your hand up.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying talking about this. I respect everything the movie's doing so much. I just, man, I wish I liked it.
Bring it home, baby. We're about 40 minutes in, and you haven't really mentioned that you don't like this movie very much. So I appreciate that, but I want you to dig in now.
I think, okay, I was really on board with the hell episodes. I was like, this is cool. The opening set of the just 37,000 dead Christians.
It's so wild. It's so Fukusaku also. It's like, it's
so
just like,
good. It is so good. All the like vignettes of I'm building my Avengers is so cool. Like the dude just under the volcano chilling.
Yeah.
Like, so sick. And then when it was like, all right, we're going to get to the standard plot of this film, the standard plot just being like, we're going to stop doing vignettes for a while and like let things happen. And just the pace fell apart for me. And I just like, I don't know. It just felt like, if you gotta tighten this bad boy up and got to the point, like it just meandered so much, and it felt like it was in that meandering was losing what was making it cool and interesting. Like those vignettes work so well because they're so compact. Like you're getting these individual theses of these people so quickly, and then once it's time to like get to the central thrust, I just felt like it was often slowing down too much to like. It would get hung up on these characters and thoughts that I just wasn't personally vibing with. And I think it comes from something as like dumb as just like, I think 2 hours is too long for this movie in my head. Like is too much movie there.
Well, I think one question that I had when I was watching this is, how does it work as an action movie? Is it an action movie? You know, do we enjoy the sword fighting? You know, like, does this rank among, you know, Sonny Chiba as a martial artist? Like, how much does it show off his abilities? Like, if we looked at the movie from that perspective, I think it does disappoint. Although the final battle, like with the castle burning all around,
it's so sick, right?
That's awesome. But like the actual, like, are we enjoying the actual sword play? It was a question that I had. Like, I don't think we're necessarily meant to see the movie that way, but certainly like completely blind going in, I was like, yeah, I'm going to see some cool, Shambhara sword action. But I don't think that that's the point of the movie. And maybe if I had been more invested in seeing something like that, I would have come away disappointed.
I do think the only cool sword fight is the oldest dude in the film, whose name I forget, Jubei's dad, just goes crazy.
He's
on a bunch
jumping
of dudes at one
around
point.
During
it's
the siege
so
of the castle.
Sick.
It's yeah. a real like Yojimbo Sanjuro moment where it's just like, hey, you want to watch Toshirô Mifune cut down like 16 dudes in 5 seconds? It's like, yeah, I do. I do want that. I think I'll defend the action a little bit, if only because I'm like a real fan of how Fukusaku shoots it, in that like Fukusaku is really distinctly not afraid of wide shots, like shots from far away where you can really see like, hey, there are 40 people, 40 human beings in this shot, right? Like I'm thinking of the duel between Yagyu and Musashi is like on a classic Japanese beach, like Lady Snowblood style. And like you see both of their bodies in almost every shot, right? Like you can actually see like swords colliding. And like, I don't want to be, maybe I'm being an overly cynical asshole here, but like I just watched Monkey Man, right? And like those fight scenes suck so bad. They're shot so poorly. And like, I remember being like, man, like, just being able to see, maybe this is damning with faint praise, but like in that scene you just described where like Yagyu's going off against people, like you see multiple people in the same shot trying to fight him, and he is distinctly like blocking and like doing choreography that you are able to see because Fukusaku is shooting from far enough away and with a still enough camera that the action is legible. And like, yes, I agree that like, ultimately, the action in this movie, maybe because it's not the point, I don't know, is kind of disappointing because it's like, it's so elevated and so silly, right? Like, it reminded me a lot, and like, this was my next talking point, I guess, but like, it's so funny that this movie is so angry and serious because it's also like Power Rangers, right?
Yeah, like, exactly, like, yeah.
Shiro literally, like, he has the hair of the 37,000 massacred Christians, and he uses it like a whip, and when he uses it like a whip, he, like, announces it. He's like, secret Christian hair weapon! Attack! And it's like, oh, like, I'm watching, like, Tokusatsu, right? Or, like, I'm watching, like, a Power Rangers movie. But it's like, it's Fukusaku doing one of those, right? So it's like, it's also going to be completely serious and earnest and angry as well. And like, it's going to pull it off amazingly. But yeah, I mean, like, ultimately, I think, yes, like, there are no real protracted duels in this. Everything is pretty short. The combat is sort of a sideshow. It's often a little too chaotic to really make out. The choreography leaves something to be desired. It's still better than like a lot of action movies. Just because it's Fukusaku, I guess. And like, that was really interesting to me, especially like, again, coming off of modern action movies.
Yeah, I gotta jump on the thing about how it is like as an action movie. I guess my expectations going in were not high. I guess I had sort of lumped it in with other supernatural jidaigeki adjacent type stuff, just like by stereotype. And so the fact that it had like decently shot and interestingly shot scenes, by the time that we get to the sieging of the castle that Blake was referencing, where Yagyu and I think it's Hokusawa are both attacking and, you know, setting the castle ablaze, and they're just flying through flame and shit. There's one shot specifically that left me kind of, if Fukusaku has more of this kind of shit in him, point me to that movie, because there's a shot where Hokusawa is running through the foreground of this, you know, burning castle at about ground level, and she's killing people and fending, you know, off a bunch of the servants trying to, you know, take the feudal lord captive. And then she moves slightly to like this left of the screen. I'm no cinematographer, but she moves off left of screen, and the camera zooms in on Yagyu in the background, like far background, out of focus, grainy, and just holds on him as he approaches the front of the frame and just like starts cutting down shit on his way. And you don't really see everything that's coming around him until he's fully in focus again. And it's like, shit, that's a fucking really great way to one, set the like shape of the scene, show like the depth, and like, again, without letting the action drop, without cutting, without inserting anything artificial to sort of like interrupt that, just fully one shot. And it's not like, you know, the most technically impressive, but it is like, it's well coordinated, it's incredibly well choreographed, and it's like those little spurts of action, those little like, I can do this, guys, type moment of that that Fukusaku and his DP must have had, were like, that's where, why I forgive some of the less I guess action-y elements of this movie, when it dives more into that, like what Blake is saying, where it slows down, some of the baloney in the middle can like feel like we're sort of letting down the tension of the really fast moving plot at the beginning. I think that's why I forgive that, is because one, I find that stuff interesting. The stuff that Blake isn't a huge fan of in this movie, I find like kind of is what's going to stick with me. But also then it makes up for it with like, we're talking about the burning castle at the end and the classic samurai sword fight on the beach and stuff. There's just like enough high points that the low points, even in action, start to feel a little bit more, I guess, defensible to me. Harry, what did you think about that?
Yeah, no, I agree. Like, for one, this is just like kind of a classic 1980s, like Japanese soundstage movie, right? Like, it just looks gorgeous, and it looks gorgeous in the sense of like theater. Like, I love the way that they have, Shiro depicted here, where he like, he's so made up with like makeup. He's played by a guy who went by Julie because of his love of Julie Andrews, and was like a famous like Japanese pop star for a time, and like really gives that, like, he's just like a gorgeous, like beautiful man, and he's like constantly mugging for the camera and like really going nuts with it. And like that, I think that like that is That's a really good point, Jason. Like, I love that you said, I can do this, because that's how I would characterize Fukusaku, is like, he's just such a competent workman director, right? It's like, this is a guy who looks like he's directed 100 fucking movies. And like, you can tell, right? Because like, everything in this movie hangs together. It's all competent. It's all workmanlike. Every piece of this works, even though it doesn't make any sense that it should work together the way it does, right? Like, what we're describing is like, it's this utterly silly, ridiculous, like Power Rangers tokusatsu movie about like samurai zombies from history rising up to fight together, right? But it's also completely serious and dour and horrific and scary, and it handles all of these things at once. And it's just because Fukusaku just commits with such like audacity, right? Like, it's a real kitchen sink movie in the way a lot of Fukusaku movies are, where it's just like, there are fucking like post effects thrown over this movie where like, when the characters are doing magic,
they're so like, fucking good.
It's so good, right? And like the last scene takes place, I didn't know how they did it, because like, there are characters who are just standing like in flames, right? And like, it looks fantastic. Like, I think the movie is really gorgeously shot. It's really well composed. There's a lot of like, a lot of filmmaking went into this thing, right? Like there are a lot of cinematic techniques at Fukusaku's disposal, and he uses them all just like a pro, right? Like the close-ups work, the broad shots work, the action shots work, the monologues work. Like, all of this is like, none of it is particularly artful, but it like, it's this great, like, if I would characterize Fukusaku as contemptuous, I would say that like, it almost bleeds over to the form itself, right? Where like, Fukusaku doesn't have time for genre, or he doesn't have time for like art house versus trash, right? He's just like, I'm just making the fucking movie I'm making. And like, that really comes out in the battles, Without Honor or Humanity, right? Which are like these great, elevated, deep movies that are also like completely like Blake said, like, action sort of like id drivers, right? Where it's like, there are boobs, there's tons of nudity in this movie, and in like the Battles Without Honor and Humanity, there's an unbelievable body count in both movies, right? Like, in like, literally in Battles Without Honor or Humanity, in the first movie, like, fully half of it just dissolves into a series of retaliatory killings, just back and forth, and it's just like, hey, name of guy, like in The Irishman, where it's just like, name of guy killed by this guy, and then it cuts, and like, that happens like 16 different times, because Fukusaku knows you want to see that shit, right? And he's just like, yeah, like, I'm going to give the audience what they want, and I'm going to make the movie I want, and I can do it all, and like, fuck you, you can't stop me, right? And it's like, yeah, you can really see that philosophy like manifest itself in his movies.
One of my favorite things has to be like how this movie, it pulls so much out of its I won't say modest. I have no idea what it cost to make this movie, but like there are sweeping implications of a plot. There's like, we've already referenced Shakespeare a few times, this very like heaven and hell, demons and humans, power and lack thereof implications on fairly, I won't say like modest, but small by comparison, small and simple sets. Like you have that incredible set piece at the beginning with 37,000 skulls all, you know, impaled on pikes. And that might be, aside from the castle that burns down, that might be like the most extensive. I guess what I'm trying to get at is like there's a certain theatricality to it, a certain like stage play likeness to all of the moments that don't have that. From the moment when he first meets Hokusawa and starts to resurrect her, and like it's just kind of remembering what happened. One scene, one set where she's like walking around recounting her tale, and another scene where, you know, you're seeing it unfold in a retrospect. And otherwise, I guess like it's fairly simple and straightforward in its blocking and staging until it becomes an action movie again. And it just feels like a very natural extension of that, where I guess to your point, Harry, like everybody, like he just has a complete mastery over all of these things. And I think he's meeting them out. I don't think he's like forgetting that it's action, that it's supposed to be actiony and interesting. I think he's like, listen, this part is going to be really important to know who this character was, because she's really important to the plot. Musashi, ultimately kind of important in that he creates like he inspires certain rivalry between Jubei and his father. But like other than that, he's not like an incredible mover of the plot. I think it's just like he knows where to put those pieces for like narrative heft or for, you know, action payoff. He just knows where to fit those pieces into. I agree with Blake, probably could have been 20 minutes shorter and removed some of the what feels like padding, but I don't know, it sustained for me for the most part. I did, partway through watching this movie, I went ahead and just bought the Blu-ray on Amazon, as I'm still quite interested in going back to this someday just to look at parts of it. I can imagine it being played behind, you know, the second best punk band in South Minneapolis at an abandoned fountain factory or something. I could imagine it just running in silent mode. I don't know. I was sort of taken with this movie.
You're just planning our future concerts, Jason.
Listen, when we get Flesh Baby up off the ground, we'll at least make it to fourth or fifth best in South Minneapolis. I guess my last thought is the one guy that you don't want to be like leading the rebellion against God is his most devout follower. It's unfortunate that like he's the one guy who survived that entire massacre. In reality, he died at 17 and had his head on a pike, but this movie presupposes, what if he didn't? What if he actually radicalized even further against God?
Old Shiro, written by the guy from the fucking Royal Tenenbaums.
You know, I don't have much to say about this. I think there's so much about this movie that it just reveals blind spots to me. Like, just like you, I don't know that much about, you know, Jidaigeki movies in the 80s. I don't know that much about sort of that time. You know, I think that is kind of a blind spot for me. And one thing I feel like this is like dissertation idea, Christian iconography in Japanese pop culture. And then I maybe in the 80s in general, there's like this kind of like satanic panic, heavy metal vibe through this whole movie that is awesome. We didn't even talk about that. There's like a crucifixion scene, which is wild. And then of course you mentioned like all of the bodies of Christians. Like I'd love to like dig into like, I don't know. There's just so many interesting examples through Japanese pop culture of like this Christian iconography.
That's like such a good point.
Evangelion is probably like one of the number one examples, but I mentioned Ghosts and Goblins and like a lot of video games like that time.
Well, and it's like, it's such an interesting inversion in the West, right? Because like at the same time and like in exactly right, like the 70s and 80s, like we had Karate Kid, we had like this sort of like Westernization of Kung Fu, all of this sort of like oriental appropriation, right, of this idea that like, oh, like, and we didn't really know anything about that stuff, but we thought it was badass as hell, so we kept trying to incorporate it. And like the same thing kind of happened in Japan, but with Christianity, right, where it's like Anno Hideki famously didn't know anything about Christianity. He was just like, oh yeah, I thought that like all of the crosses and stuff looked really cool, and like it made it feel heavy and like metal as fuck, so I put it into Evangelion. And like it works so well, right? But it is hilarious and wild to see, like, as a person who was like Western and raised Christian, like that, like there was just like this total appropriation of Christian aesthetics just because they looked really cool in Japan that sort of like paralleled with the way that we appropriated Japanese aesthetics.
But I think what's so fascinating about this movie is that it does more than that, right? Because it goes back to an actual time where Christianity had some sort of relevance in Japanese culture. So it's like trying to plumb like an actual connection in some sense, which I think is fascinating.
And actual like grisly fucking tragedy, right? Like 37,000 people were executed by a government. That's fucking crazy.
But it also just looks cool, and it's imposing when a guy gets, he's hung right from the rafters, by the Christian woman's hair, and like he's then branded with a like Judeo-Christian cross on his forehead. Like it does just, that's just fucking cool. That's cool. I mean, in addition to like, yes, I do want to know the Blake's got it on up on command. God, it's so fucking sick, isn't it?
It was such a good visual. I just pulled my phone out, took a picture of it to have.
There is like a lot, I think, to be said for, because like Harry grew up with some of these exposure, and I was like, oh, this piece of foreign media to me has like symbols that I recognize. And it's just because I guess like I never stopped to question as a kid or even as a teen, like, why is that? What is the cultural underpinning for Japanese society in like Judeo-Christian imagery and concepts? And I find it really interesting, like to your point, Chris, that like this is not just leveraging of that. It's like, hey, this is, we're actually touching on a piece of history. I mean, we're making it like part of the text rather than just NGE subtext, you know?
It's like, Chris, they said they said it was like a satanic panic movie. And it's kind of like that. It's like a Christian panic movie, right? It's like, oh, you better not fuck with Christians because like they'll sick their like weird fucking demons on you, man. It's like there's like a real,
they're all
like
born with golden eyes,
like fear of this religion that you don't really know, that seems outside of like your culture, and that seems strange and maybe powerful in some sort of exotic way, except the exoticism from like in a Western perspective is inverted, right? It's like we would tell scary stories about like the Oriental magics, and they're over here like, what about those like Christian magics from like those crazy white like psychopaths in the West that like summon demons and shit, right? It's fascinating and kind of hilarious.
Yeah. And actually, you draw a really great parallel, which I didn't even consider, that there are tons of examples of the opposite, like Big Trouble in Little China or like Gremlins, where, you know, the crazy special effects monsters come from Chinatown, from, you know, like you said, this Oriental mysterious place. Like this movie is basically the opposite of that, where it's just like Christians are the scary demon conjuring people. Yeah, like I didn't even make that connection.
And there's sort of a criticism implicit in that, right? Like, yeah. I don't know if Fukusaku was like consciously inverting that sort of appropriation for the purposes of this movie, but in effect, that's what happens, right? It's sort of through the looking glass. It's like, hey, like, look at what like Christianity looks like when you exotify it the way that like Japanese culture is often exotified.
We are nearly out, I think, if everybody's done with their larger discussion points. Thank you very much, everybody. We have a couple little tiny segments left. I'll get through the quick one. It's called To All the Loves We've Tried Before, movies that we've covered that are in this, that were released in the year of this movie. We have episode 82 on Son of the White Mare, an animated, I think it was Hungarian animated film. We covered that movie with Sarah Huskin of the Trilon, of Cult Film Collective. Time Bandits, episode 109 with Seth Zarati. I will admit to remembering none of that movie at all, but I remember it being a fun conversation. The Aviator's Wife took episode 148. It was our first film covered in the Eric Romare series, if I remember correctly.
Great movie.
I do remember more of that movie than I remember of Time Bandits, I will say. And then episode 153, give it up for Blake Hester and his first guest appearance on Trilove. Was it your first for Possession? 1981 release.
That's right.
And the podcast was never
the
same.
Dude, what was going on in the world in 1981 that we got Possession and Samurai Reincarnation?
We also got Road Games, which we covered in episode 198, almost 100 episodes ago. Can you imagine that, Harry? And only 10 episodes ago, we had Brian De Palma's Blowout. Indeed, the film Blowout, the freak Brian De Palma himself. And that was just 10 episodes ago. So, hey, adding one more to the checkbox from 1981. Bring more 1981 movies to the podcast. Hey, raise your hand.
1981 was crazy, y'all. The first Decline of Western Civilization came out.
Hell yeah.
Miss 45. Man. Halloween 2. Some crazy shit was going on.
Yeah. That's man, movies used to be huge.
Where does this one rank among you, or among your 1981 films then, Blake? Like, Possession, I'm assuming.
Possession's the goat. Also, the first Gundam film came out in 1981.
Whoa.
Decline
was
of Western...
Was that Char's Counterattack?
Mobile Suit Gundam 1.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I really love Decline of Western Civilization. The first one...
Oh, yeah, it's the best.
I love the first and second one. The third one is a little too crusty for me. That's hard to
you guys are forgetting. You guys are forgetting the best movie from 1981.
What's up?
Mad Max 2.
Oh, yeah. Man. Holy shit. That's wild.
Hold on. Also, Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Oh, yeah.
Also,
right.
Getting rid of Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Okay. The 1981.
The second best movie of 1981.
How did I miss that then? Because we covered the Raiders.
The Killing of America also came out. Very famous shock movie. What a year. We all know where we were in 1981.
In 1981.
Yeah. Oh, the
it was
heavy
like
metal
it was
film?
Yesterday.
The heavy metal film came out.
Never actually saw that.
Scanners came out in 81.
Oh, damn. My God.
The that's, Evil Dead, Lucio Fulci's The Beyond.
The Evil Dead came out in 1981?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Friday
that was
the
when
13th,
Sam Raimi
two?
Was like 20 years old when he made yeah. that movie, right? That's insane.
Dude. Goated year for sure.
That's Valentine. Why we got to bring back, like, we got to stop making it so that like every movie costs $300 trillion to make yeah. because like that's why there were so many movies back then because like they didn't all cost $10 trillion to make.
Yeah.
Movies used to be good, and we cover some of them here on Trilove. The final segment of our show for today is going to be the junk drawer, which
nope, bro. Are you kidding me?
You, have you can the do real it in real time
drawer.
As well.
You have the real junk drawer right here.
Here it is. Ready.
There you go.
Incredible. It there really did kind of sound like sample. The original. Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go. It's actually, it has more junk in it now, which I don't know if it makes it better or worse.
I think it does. I think it makes it better. More beef, more value. I will say for my junk drawer thought, the dub of this is so fucking bad. I watched part of it on Tubi before deciding that I really couldn't understand or like appreciate anything about this movie if I had to watch the dub. But now that I've seen it, maybe I'll go back because it was so incredibly awfully off-putting that nobody's not just, you know, the typical problems with a dub where things just don't line up and it's harder to like imagine the person saying those things, but really the translation and localization of some of these concepts are just there. Like I literally watched maybe 3 minutes of this and couldn't, so I cannot, you know, warn you away enough from the dub of this movie. But one of the things that does come through in the sub version is when Hokusawa's husband is deriding her for her Christianity in her flashback sequence before she's actually resurrected. He says, "Why don't you go marry Jesus?" in the fucking funniest way.
He also it's thinks like, it's so funny, dude. He laughs his ass off at his own joke.
It's kind
too,
of funny. Like, if you know a little bit about Catholicism, it's a pretty funny joke to make. Like, you're literally the bride of Christ shit.
Right. It's like, yeah, good. I mean, that's kind of the whole thing.
That's
right.
Very funny. Those are my junk drawer thoughts. Chris, was there anything else that you just had bobbling around your head, shots that worked great, funny shit doesn't work in the larger context of our conversation that you wanted to rattle off before we close out?
Well, I feel like we didn't talk enough about Shogun, which I just started watching, so I'm not caught up. But
same.
I mean, just thinking about the parallels there. I mean, the obvious one of Hiroyuki Sanada's appearance, but just the fact that, you know, some of the has characters in common, right, with Shogun. That's actually a weird thing about Shogun is that it's about real people and real things, but he changes all the names for some reason. I don't really understand.
Yeah, it's like it was written by a white dude in like the 70s, yeah. But it is, again, a historical fiction. I really like Shogun. I have like this weird issue with it where it's like the first episode, which is mostly about the Japanese characters, right? And features some of the greatest Japanese actors working today. And they're like doing politics, and that stuff is so fascinating that, like, unfortunately, like, it has a little bit of like the Martin Scorsese silent issue that, like, when it cuts back to, like, when it remembers that it has to tell the story of the book and it becomes about the Englishman and his sort of like outsider experience with Japan, it's like, can I maybe like just go back to the can I watch those Japanese dudes like do their thing a little bit more? And it's just sort of like, you know, like I get it. Like, I know that like this is the story, but it is sort of like, man, like what if like we didn't need the white dude? Like, what if we just told the story of like all of these shoguns like fighting over political control?
But yeah, it's crazy because, you know, that's all new stuff, right? Like, that's not in the book, and that's not in the 80s version with Toshio Mifune. They don't even have subtitles on the Mifune version because it's meant to be entirely from the Europeans' perspective. We don't even get to understand the Japanese. So all that stuff, like, I haven't seen that 80s version.
No, I'm planning on rewatching it or going back to it because I'm fascinated by it, especially, like, you learn that Toshio Mifune was in it. I was just like, oh, I have to check that out.
Yeah, and what year was that? Was that also 1981?
I think it was in the... Oh, shit, was it? It wasn't in... I think it was a little bit later. Oh, 80? Holy shit, earlier.
Yeah. So pretty interesting.
Which also, like, wild that, like, it was a TV miniseries, which is super unusual, I feel, for 1980.
And, I kind of disagree. I think that was more popular than, like, you had Roots.
Oh, that's a good point.
That's, like, the infamous... That's, like, the Citizen Kane of TV miniseries.
In the 80s, or was that 90s?
I think that was in the 90s.
Okay. Roots was in the 80s because it was pre-TNG, pre-Star Trek. Right?
So ones like Roots and It, these helped popularize the form of
two really famous and beloved miniseries.
Yes. You know,
Roots and Stephen King's It.
easy to interchange them in conversation. Yeah.
I would say my junk drawer thoughts, I know it's like so weeby, but like every time a new historical figure was introduced in this movie, I was like absolutely like the pointing at the screen, like mouth open, like, holy shit, here we go. Right. It was like playing Samurai Warriors or like Neo or something. Right. Like, I kept waiting and like, I know that like this is not historical. Like, these characters are not contemporaries, but I kept waiting for them to go to fucking Oda Nobunaga and like resurrect his ass. I was just like, they gotta get Oda, right? Like, they gotta get Nobunaga up in here. But they didn't, unfortunately. But like, that is also such a fun, like, I kept trying to think of like an American analog, and there really isn't one, but it's like, what if like Robert E. Lee like was resurrected in like the 1940s and was just like going ham on like American GIs, right? It's sort of like, just to like characterize what a ridiculous premise this movie is and how wild it is that it works as well as it does.
I'll point you to two video games. I mean, shoot me after I mention both of these, but The Order 1886 and Codename Steam. I really like Order 1886. I had a fun time with that. Codename Steam. Both of those are like American historical fiction, and just, well, not American. Order 1886 touches on American history, but like very Western version of this. Goofy, over the top bullshit. Highly recommend both of those games if you're looking for that. I mean, it's never quite as directly subversive or angry as this movie is in a fun way.
And if you're looking for Japanese versions, there's like a Dragon Ishin, which uses a bunch of characters from this.
He's just gonna
it becomes a weird, then becomes like a weird nationalist nightmare in the last 1 minute.
Rough. Yeah, there's
it's
a there's
so
some
strange.
Yeah, the Yakuza games politics are fascinating and strange. And there's Onimusha. Onimusha's pretty good. Neo, obviously, is a big one.
Is Tenchu a historical fiction?
I don't know. I've never played Tenchu.
Me either. Well, questions we have on Trilove.
Yeah. Cody's not here, so we get to talk about video games. That's just how it works.
Yeah, nobody gets to turn off their camera, as Cody does when we start talking about video games. But it sounds like that's probably... Blake, did you have any junk drawer thoughts?
Of course. Listen, I got junk drawer thoughts.
You're the junk drawer man.
Here's the thing. Okay. I'm just going to use this opportunity to shout out movies I love. Kenji Sawada, who plays the big Christian dude, he rocks. He's like, he used to be a big time pop star, but he's in some like really badass movies. He's in Shinya Tsukamoto's Hiroko the Goblin, which is like one of
hell yes hell yeah, yeah.
It's one of Tsukamoto's like weirdo films because
it's
like,
so one of, fucking weird, man.
It's one of the like studio projects he took. It's not like a Tsukamoto joint. It's really strange. He's also in Takashi Miike's comedy horror musical Happiness of the Katakuris. And that movie fucking slayed.
That movie's so that fucking
amazing
good.
Movie. So, yeah, we that watched so good.
Just before the pandemic first hit, we watched that with some friends at their house. Oh my God.
It's awesome.
What a movie.
So I was really stoked when he popped up in this movie. My God, please watch more Fukusaku movies. The Battles Without Honor and Humanity. I mean, Battle Royale is a good starting point for all Western folk, I feel like. But The Battles Without Honor and Humanity. What is a 5-movie quintology? What do you call that?
Something movies. Like that.
Yeah, whatever. Yeah. They're so good. Well, the third one I think is pretty bad, but it's just because it has to politic to get from the second to the fourth. The second movie, which like kind of drops the plot of the entire series to focus on this like other side character, is the best of them all. It's probably Fukusaku's best movie that I've seen, which is he's directed like over 60 movies. So just because I've seen 10 doesn't really mean much, I guess. Also, he made a movie called Graveyard of Honor, which I don't think is all that great. But
I like it a lot. But yeah,
Takashi. Well, maybe this is the problem because I saw it after Takashi Miike's remake of it, which is one of my favorite movies of all time.
Like, I haven't seen the Miike version. That's fantastic.
I legitimately, unironically, like, say what you will about Goodfellas and all this, one of my favorite movies. I think this sits
amazing
right alongside the great mob movies.
Also, it's so appropriate because Miike is like kind of the Fukusaku successor.
For sure.
And so like it totally makes sense that he would inherit that.
Yeah. So I highly, highly recommend the Graveyard of Honor remake. The original's easily accessible. So is the remake. And Arrow put out a box set of both films, which is really cool. So you can get them both, watch them both. In the Battle Royale box set, the collector's edition that maybe isn't sold anymore, Tom Mess wrote a book, a like short biography of Fukusaku that I highly recommend if you can find, because it just like tells you his whole shit. Tom Mess writes in a way that is a little hard to parse sometimes because he has so much knowledge and fills the page with so much of it that it's like you can't even pretend to contain
like, is
it all.
It academic
but
in nature? What is
it's,
he?
Yes. Okay. That's a good way to put it. Like it's one of those like academic writings where you're like, you are so smart and I'm gonna remember 10% of this. But that 10% will help you in the long run. And then finally, people like to talk about how Fukusaku's last film was Battle Royale 2, which he only shot one scene of before he passed away, and his son, Kinta Fukusaku, had to take over, finish the film, Battle Royale 2 Requiem. Pretty maligned, not considered very good. However, that's a falsehood. It is not his final project. His final finished project are the cutscenes for the video game Clock Tower 3.
Fuck,
go
yes,
seek them
fuck,
out.
Yes.
It's so crazy because you watch the cutscenes of this PlayStation 2 game and you're like, that's Fukusaku. That is Fukusaku right there.
That's wild.
And there's a making of, I believe it's on YouTube. It came out on DVD in Japan. This making of him like making cutscenes. He's literally 70 years old making this weird Capcom horror game the cutscenes for this weird Capcom horror game. And they fucking feel like Kenji Fukusaku is directing them. It's so
that's
fucking
so
sick.
That's so wild.
I've never played the game, but the cutscenes go hard and they're easy to find.
It seems like one of those cult classic games that everybody who plays it is like, it's the best that you've never played. And then you play it and it's like, it was fine. But
I really want to play those
rocks.
Games.
Yeah. It makes you wonder, like, did he last long enough to get anywhere near like the age of highly CGI'd movies? Cause it seems like a different discipline. If he's going to be able to carry one directorial style from like predominantly live action to like a fucking PS2 game, that he might have had some interesting shit to do with CGI.
I want to say he died in like 2003, and he died in 2003. There's like some CG stuff in Battle Royale. I haven't watched Requiem to know if there's any in that, but that's kind of pushing it. But like
right,
I mean, the early 2000s, they still had mocap, like you were still able to. It was obviously very primitive comparatively, but like you can see the making of and be like, that's the skeleton of how we still make cutscenes, and like they look good because Capcom and Konami, like that, all those companies were on some other shit back then with that PS2, making really impressive shit. And like it felt
video
like
games used to be good too, man. Yeah. I feel so old. It's like used to be good, video games used to be good. We got to go back.
It really felt like he made some impressive shit for the time. And last thing, if you have a lot of money to import t-shirts, or you go to Tokyo on vacation, go to Hardcore Chocolate. They're an independent clothing retailer. I don't want to say they're indie as in their small upstart, like they do deals with A24 and like Fox and shit.
Yeah.
But they have a whole line with, I don't know what it would be, Toei or the Fukusaku estate, but they have Fukusaku shirts, Battles Without Honor and Humanity shirts. Like they do this whole Fukusaku Battles line, and I think they deserve all the love and attention they get because their store is awesome. Everyone that works there is awesome. They make the coolest shit ever. So if you're ever over there,
yeah, stop by. I mean, it might be cheaper.
$30 shirts.
Yeah, it might be cheaper as long as it's not Sakura season. It might be cheaper to just get a ticket and then you know, buy in person.
I will say the one import I did cost me $100 for a medium.
Jesus,
it was not,
I'm not
worth
kidding.
It, so
I'm not kidding. You could stow away on a plane and get to Japan for less than that if you wanted to.
So now I buy them when I'm there, but they did a guinea pig too shirt, and I was like, I don't want this to sell out, so I did import that one. So that's my drunk draw. I'm sorry to monopolize the conversation, but that's it.
Thank you. I find it normal. I was just going to close out by saying I'm going to work my damnedest. I'm going to watch those cutscenes, and I'm going to work my damnedest to get them listed on Letterboxd. So I appreciate you can check this feed for updates on that project. Thanks so much, y'all, both of you, for being on our podcast to talk about this weird, weird, fun movie. Chris, just remind everybody again where they can find you on the internet, and I guess if you want them to find you and how.
Oh. Well, I guess my Twitter is my name, which maybe is not smart. Maybe I need to change that. But it's at Chris_Montello. And I program AIFF, Asian American International Film Festival, which can be found at AIFF.org, A-A-I-F-F .org. And our 47th annual festival is August 1st here in New York
City. 47, that's
what,
so
what was,
cool.
What was it like to program the first one?
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, actually, I could introduce you to the people that did. It's like, wow. A lot of people have been around since that time.
Nice. That's so awesome. Got an attach rate on that shit. Well, good luck putting together this year's. It's in August, you said, the film festival?
Yeah. August 1st through 10th.
You'll find links to all of those things in the show notes, listener. Blake, people who've listened to this show certainly know your name and your provenance. Where do you want people to find you on the internet these days?
Somethingrotten.bigcartel.com between now and a week and a half from now. Please go give me between $30 and $60 for some very sick merch that will directly help me pay my rent.
I have even finished Disco Elysium, and yet I'm going to own a Something Rotten Disco Elysium themed shirt. I have no idea what it's referencing. Just looks neat. Looks metal. I imagine I'll get some compliments at some punk shows around.
Thank
you. I guess expedite mine. I hear that they're good quality, better quality than you might expect.
They're printed in Louisville, Kentucky, by Audiophile Inc., I believe is the name. They printed all the local band shirts for as long as I can remember their shirts. I have shirts that those dudes printed that I bought when I was 16 that still look great.
Wow. So we 40 year old shirts and they're still around.
40 year old shirt. That's right. The art is all done by Johnny Munch, who runs From the Void Clothing, is the bass player of Grey Haven. So,
I just listened to their EP.
Their bassist is, I grew up with him. He does all our merch designs for us, but that specifically was like, he made art for it.
Nice.
So that's where I want people to find me, in a place where they can give me fucking money.
Just scroll down and hit the big gigantic button that says pay Blake money here. Thank you so much both for being on the podcast. We hope you'll come back. I know Blake, you probably will, but Chris, thank you for reaching out. Thank you for being on our episode. Really.
Yeah. You really saved our butts here. Oh, yeah. So thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. Let me know when you do an Obayashi.
Oh, don't worry. Man. It's we not would unlikely. Love that. we've been trying for a little while to get John Moret, the programmer of the Trilon, to program a little bit more because I don't think they played anything more than Haosu, have they, Harry?
Haosu's the only one. We've done two on the podcast. We've done this and His Motorbiker Island, which is like maybe a top five movie for me. Beautiful. But yeah, he hasn't programmed very many Obayashis, and they just released that Criterion Collection set. Right?
Did they?
Or is it a Criterion?
I know. No, it's third window. Kino is third like this window. UK distributor.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, yeah. Okay, you're right. But yeah, we'll definitely hit you up. That would be fantastic.
Thanks, y'all, for being on. Thank you for listening. You can find us on Twitter at Trilove Podcast. You can find me. I help make this show on Twitter at Nintendoofus.
I'm Harry Mack, and you can find me on Twitter at PunishTake.
Everybody just give a nice big wave goodbye. Thank you, everybody. Have a good one.